This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. And the papers want to know whose shirts you wear. And I'm floating in a most peculiar way. And the stars look very different today.
Hello and welcome to Season 3, Episode 8 of Space Talks, a half-hour science-based show with an interest in all things space. I'm Stephen Lowry, along with co-host Tim Wids on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim, tell us about today's topic.
In previous episodes, we've turned our focus to some of our planetary neighbors, such as Venus, Mars, and Neptune. This week, we're going to talk about a tiny planet located between the Sun and Mercury. We're full of surprises here on Space Talks, don't you think, Steve?
Well, I do, Tim. And before we go looking down the wrong end of a telescope, perhaps we should have a look at a couple of updates.
Well, I have a changing of the guard story for my update today. It wasn't long ago that we heard President Trump say back in 2018, in July of that year, that America was going to be creating a new branch of the military it would call the U.S. Space Force. Little quote here from President Trump at the time. He said, "It is so important that we have dominance in space." Well, that's a scary thought, I think, and it's certainly a long way from the United Nations declarations about non-proliferation of weapons in space, but here's the recent update to that story. So we all remember names like Boeing and Lockheed. Those were the corporations that built many elements of NASA's space program. And not surprisingly, those same companies were also very active in the defense business, but they're not making much of it in this 21st century, and in October of this year, the Space Force announced the winner of 9 out of 9 new contracts for transporting military gear into space, a contract worth about $1 billion in Canadian funds. A year ago, 3 companies passed the first gate to compete. And those companies were SpaceX, owned by Elon Musk, Blue Origin, owned by Jeff Bezos of Amazon fame, and a merged company putting Boeing and Lockheed into one company, which was called the United Launch Alliance. ULA, as it's known, tried very hard to meet the next hurdle of successful launches with their new rocket and have that done in time for the awarding of this contract, but they failed. Blue Origin's new rocket, called New Glenn, is nearly ready for testing this year, but they never thought it would be ready for this particular contract. So the winner was SpaceX, and it sure seems like the problems plaguing ULA could push them entirely to the sideline. And that would leave, Steve, the U.S. Air Force becoming dependent on 2 single billionaires, Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, both of whom must really like the idea of being involved in dominating space.
Our requisite research consistently reveals new-to-us facts, and my update this week is no exception to that rule. Now, last week we mentioned how the Sun has a 22-year geomagnetic cycle, whereby its north magnetic pole flips to being south, and then 11 years later it flips back. And this week, scientists have managed to interpolate Earth's data into sound to create what the Earth's moving magnetic field must have sounded like.
I think most listeners knew the magnetic poles are always moving a bit, but are we talking about a complete flip where the Earth's north becomes south and vice versa?
Exactly so, Tim. But don't hold your breath on this one. Our magnetic field, which cocoons the Earth, shielding us from the Sun's most dangerous rays, dwindled in strength some 41,000 years ago. And then this pole suddenly flipped for about 250 years before reverting back.
I can well imagine that had our early ancestral humans been in possession of compasses, they might have noticed this change in polarity. And this certainly would have caused havoc with the migrating birds, which actually rely on magnetic lines of force to guide their travels.
And so, for a brief moment in geological time, our North Pole became south. And now, for the first time, we can hear the sound of that upheaval. Well, not quite. By using data collected from the European Space Agency's Swarm satellite mission, a team of scientists from the Technical University of Denmark and a German research center for geosciences have transformed our magnetic flip-flop 41,000 years ago, which incidentally was known as the Lachance event, into a soundscape built from the movements of those magnetic lines.
Granted, Steve, that's pretty interesting, but come on. What could be more interesting than another planet hiding between Mercury and the Sun?
What are you talking about? A planet closer to the Sun? Listen, have you been dusting off Isaac Asimov on some Clifford D. C-Mac books? What is this all about? And it better be about Mercury.
Yeah, it is actually, but here's another tease. You might say this imaginary planet is also home to an imaginary science officer who served Captain Kirk for many years aboard the imaginary Starship Enterprise.
Okay, I've got the popcorn going. You start the show, Tim.
You bet. Okay, so it all started back in the middle of the 19th century when astronomers had a problem. They were trying to figure out Mercury's orbit. It's elliptical, but not perfectly so. Every orbit seemed to be a little bit different than the last one, and that's a phenomenon known as precession. And we're going to get into that a little bit later, but for now, here's the deal. Astronomers were having a lot of success figuring out our universe when they applied Newton's laws of motion. However, when they used those same laws to observe the orbit of the closest planet to the Sun, something wasn't right. And the problem wasn't enormous, but it was real.
With regard to Mercury's elliptical path, and by the way, all of our planets have elliptical paths, Mercury's perihelion is 46 million kilometers from the Sun, and its aphelion is 70 million kilometers from the Sun. And at this juncture, I can well imagine listeners saying, well, so what? What's the big deal? Well, the big deal is, for comparative purposes, the Earth's perihelion is 147 million kilometers, and its aphelion is just a little bit bigger at 152 million kilometers. And this means the difference between Mercury's closest and furthest orbit changes by a whopping 75%, whereas for the Earth, it's almost circular with a difference of only 3%. But I suspect, Tim, that's not where the problem about Mercury's orbit arose back over 100 years ago.
And you would be right. It was theorized that to account for its peculiar orbit, something must be tugging on Mercury, like, for example, another planet. A few years later, in 1859, Le Verrier was at it again, searching for a missing planet to account for the discrepancies in the orbit of Mercury. And though he couldn't find one, he did give this planet a name, setting off a hunt by astronomers around the world, and the name of that planet? Vulcan.
And no doubt he chose that name for the Roman god of fire and metalworking due to its proximity to the Sun, and not for the town of Vulcan, Alberta, where, by the way, they have constructed a replica of the Star Trek Enterprise and hold annual Spock Day events.
Okay, newsflash. They never actually did find Vulcan, although some astronomers did claim to have seen evidence, but of course they were wrong. And that sort of reminds me of some other astronomers who claimed to have seen watery canals on Mars.
And so there was no Vulcan planet to account for a strange behavior in Mercury's orbit. And so, as we always like to say, but wait, there's more. Just how did we ever figure out Mercury's strange orbit?
You know, to tell you the truth here, the story is actually way more surprising and certainly way more significant because it involves nothing short of the proof that Albert Einstein's theory of relativity is superior to Newton's laws of motion in explaining our universe.
Now, we know Einstein published his theory of relativity in 1915. And so now, Tim, on you go.
Einstein's theory suggested that light could be made to bend when it came in proximity to heavier objects such as the Sun, at least enough so that it should be possible to measure it. Of course, from our human eye perspective, light runs in a very straight line, period. But Einstein had equations that suggested otherwise. And given the magnitude of his theory, scientists around the world set out to find observational evidence one way or another.
And one technique did seem possible even back in those days, Tim, and that was to take advantage of a solar eclipse, which blackens the skies, and it was a great idea that actually did work. I'm going to take a stab at explaining the experiment without the benefit of any graphics, so I suppose this is a bit of a mind experiment, as they used to say in the days. To pull off that experiment, it was necessary to know that there was a forthcoming total solar eclipse, and where it would occur, because only portions of Earth experience an eclipse at any given time. As it was, eclipse timetables were well understood over 100 years ago, so there's no problem there. The next stop, you've literally got to go where totality will occur, and you have to do so in advance, and on what might be in the middle of nowhere. And then during a clear night, in advance of totality, you have to focus your portable telescopes and capture on film a crystal clear recording of where some prominent stars are relative to each other, remembering that the photons from those stars arrived following a straight path. And finally, now that the stage has been set and Acts 1 and 2 have metaphorically been played out, the audience of astronomers awaited the final act of ecliptic totality, during which time they took new photographs.
Right on, Steve. And that's what was done first by the English astronomer Arthur Eddington in 1919. And you can imagine the irony. Just think of it. Just after World War I, a British astronomer is about to view a solar eclipse for signs that a German physicist may have been right about warps in the universe. And so it was on May 29 that Eddington observed a lengthy solar eclipse off the coast of West Africa. Now, simultaneously, astronomers took observations from the Brazilian town of Sobral. These two teams recorded where the stars of the Hyades cluster was, which forms the bull's face in the constellation Taurus, and it appeared to be in the sky, and compared those observations with Eddington's earlier notes about where the stars normally were. His recordings seemed to point to Einstein being right, but, Steve, there were doubters. And that led to yet another experiment during a solar eclipse in 1922 taking place in Australia. This engaged some scientific missions from a few countries, actually. Britain, America, Australia, Canada, and India, those were the ones I found, each nation crafting its own experiment. Several of them failed, but two succeeded, and both delivered the proof needed, and that would be the American project, and that was led by William Wallace Campbell. And the Canadian project was largely crafted by none other than our own John Plaskett of Victoria's Dominion Astrophysical Observatory. And Steve, at a recent trip to the observatory that I had, it was my fortune to see some of the original plates taken of that eclipse. They were brought back to the observatory, and strangely enough, they were lost for a very, very long time, and just recently found. But I digress. What they found during the moment of the eclipse was a slightly different map of the stars that would become visible when the usual light from our sun was being blocked by the moon. Quite simply, the orbit of Mercury is affected by the sun's immense gravity. And it's not just the force of gravity pulling on Mercury, it's also the fact that the sun's mass actually warps the space around it. Okay, so Einstein's theory showed that massive objects like the sun don't just pull on things with gravity, they curve the space and time around them. This curved space-time caused Mercury's orbit to shift in ways that Newton's laws couldn't explain. However, when Einstein's equations were applied to the puzzle, they perfectly explained the small planet's orbit, solving a mystery that had baffled astronomers for decades. And it would turn out that Mercury would play yet another role in confirming Einstein's theory much later, all the way to the 1960s. And this time, it was the American physicist who had an idea for an experiment involving radar and Mercury. His name, Irvin Shapiro. And he conducted his famous experiment in 1964 when he was working at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology using their Haystack radar antenna.
You say his experiment involved radar, which to my mind is pretty much in the same category as light, something that fires energy in straight lines. And that's, of course, why we use radar for that very purpose, to track moving or distant objects. So what did Shapiro have in mind with radar and Mercury?
He wanted to prove that time dilates or slows down for photons traveling in high gravitational fields. And we must remember that photons of light and radar are considered the same thing. So the radar signals used in his experiments were bounced off Mercury and Venus when they were on the opposite side of the sun from Earth. And this allowed him to measure the delay in the travel time of these signals as they pass through the sun's gravitational field. The energy was slowed down by 200 microseconds.
And speaking of time, it's analogy time again. Consider an object traveling the same distance, but along two different kinds of surfaces, one being very smooth, the other slightly rough. You measure the time taken to travel a smooth path, and it's slightly faster than that taken on the somewhat rough track. Something must have slowed that object down. In this case, it would be friction.
However, according to general relativity, the distance around a more massive object is curved and longer. And Shapiro's measurements proved the space-time path around the sun was 60 kilometers longer, and hence the radar photons took longer to travel that extra distance. This experiment became quite famous, and it is known today as the Shapiro time delay experiment.
And before we move on to more recent explorations of Mercury, we got to talk briefly about one other odd aspect of Mercury, and that's something which is really rare in our system. Mercury's year, which is one lap around the sun, is a mere 88 Earth days long compared to our 365.
Actually, it's not surprising, as the farther away a planet is, the slower its orbital period. So what's the weird thing, Steve?
As we all know, a solar day on Earth from sunrise to sunset is 24 hours. But on Mercury, it's not 24 hours. It's not 48 hours. No, it's a whopping 1,408 hours, which equates to 59 Earth days long. And this is due to Mercury's very, very slow rotational speed about its axis. And speaking of slow, can you imagine how long a Monday would seem on that planet?
Imagine this. One day on Mercury is actually longer than a year, with a single day lasting about 176 Earth days. So it's pretty obvious that we're talking about a completely different reference point of time when comparing Mercury to Earth. Although Mercury has been observed for a very long time, it has remained more of a mystery than one might imagine, mostly as a result of the planet being quite small, about the size of our moon, but also its proximity to the sun. In fact, you can go all the way back to 3000 BC to find early references to the planet made by the Sumerians. Now, I'll admit I didn't know much about these people, but a little research online helped out on that front.
Likewise, Tim, dates and events in antiquity don't gel too well in my synapses. Sumerians lived in what we now call Iraq, but I'm curious about their interest in astronomy. So what's the story there?
Well, not that surprisingly, this civilization looked to the sky and conflated their religious beliefs with the movements they saw above in the night sky. And to their credit, they would record what they saw and measured using their own written language. They're given credit for writing up what we might now call a star chart, detailing the movements of the stars and the five planets that are visible to the naked eye, those being Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. Of course, they didn't have telescopes back then in 3000 BC.
Now, you've mentioned that Mercury is hard to spot, given both its size and solar proximity, but it is visible at both dawn and dusk, and that can be confusing. Could you explain why?
Sure. The Sumerians actually imagined there to be two planets, but they were not the first to make or the last to make that mistake, because you can see it in the morning and in the evening. How do you explain that? Well, there's two planets. The mistakes were being made of that nature all the way through to Greek times. It was a common misconception.
So if we fast forward to the 20th century, when we Earthlings started exploring our solar system with spacecraft, I'm not surprised to report there have only been a couple of missions to focus on Mercury. The first was NASA's Mariner 10, which would fly by in the 1970s, and it provided the first close-up images of the planet's surface. You can easily have a look at those photos by conducting a little online searching of your own, and Mariner transmitted pictures of about 45% of the surface, and it seems that it's all the pitted and scarred, not unlike our moon's surface. Decades later, MESSENGER ventured to Mercury, orbiting the planet between 2011 and 2015, and though impressive, no doubt your average citizen on the street has never heard of the MESSENGER mission.
But okay, this was 40 years later. MESSENGER must have had some better technology than the Mariner 10 spacecraft. Did it turn up anything exciting, Steve?
I think it did, and for a mere $450 million, I think the mission was a bargain. Now, how about this? We already knew that without an environment, Mercury was going to get very hot during the day and very cold at night. The daytime peaking, let's say 430 degrees Celsius, and then dropping to minus 180 degrees at night. Now, this radical temperature change from day to night, even considering the length of each, shouldn't be too surprising, especially if you've ever been to the desert here on Earth. And here, it's blistering hot in the day, and you'd expect it to remain warm at night as well, but oh no. In our typical BC summers where it's hot in the day, say 29 degrees, the night might cool to maybe 21 degrees due to cloud cover and vegetation trapping the heat. Deserts, however, cool off dramatically because they lack humidity and vegetation. Hello, Mercury, sit up and take notice, it's freezing all night long.
But what we didn't expect to find was ice, and yes, I said it, ice. Using a neutron spectrometer, MESSENGER identified ice water deposits in craters near the North Pole. They're located in such a way that they never come into sunlight and are therefore forever shrouded in darkness. Now, over the 4 years spent orbiting Mercury, MESSENGER did a great deal of science focusing on mapping and analyzing the planet's magnetic field. And to top things off, when the spacecraft was running out of fuel, they ended things with a bang, crashing the spacecraft into the planet to create what it actually didn't really need, one more crater. And as we said earlier, one of the great challenges about exploring Mercury is getting into orbit around this tiny planet. Now, think of this. You've launched a spacecraft and you're pointing it towards Mercury, which means, in effect, you're actually pointing it towards the sun. And therein lies the problem, the gravity of the sun. That gravity is strong enough to make it all but impossible to slow down with the fuel that's available to be brought on board. There's simply too much gravity, and it'd just be too heavy to have that much fuel. So what is the solution? It was tried and was successful on the MESSENGER flight, and they used what they called gravity assists to slow the spacecraft down. MESSENGER was launched in 2004, but catch this, it didn't get there until 2011, taking 7 whole years.
This solution of getting into orbit around Mercury using reverse gravity is really fascinating, and it tickles my brain. And the technique that was used with MESSENGER is being used now as we speak with a new spacecraft called BEPI Colombo, named after scientist, mathematician, and engineer Giuseppe BEPI Colombo. And he first proposed the interplanetary gravity assist maneuver that was used by the 1974 Mariner 10 mission, a technique now used frequently by planetary probes.
Got to come back to that. BEPI Colombo. That's got to be one of the all-time great names for an unmanned space mission. I'd like to play a short clip which will give us a sense of just what this new mission to Mercury entails. This European Space Agency recording was dating back to the 2018 launch. And while the plan was good, something caused it to change. But first, let's listen to the clip.
Fueled and almost ready to go, the final assembly of the BEPI Colombo mission to Mercury. A collaboration between ESA and the Japanese space agency JAXA, BEPI Colombo consists of two scientific orbiters. Protected by hand-stitched ceramic thermal blankets, the entire spacecraft is 6.5 meters high and will only just fit inside the fairing of its Ariane 5 launcher. Designed to withstand temperatures of up to 450 degrees Celsius, BEPI Colombo is one of the most technically and scientifically complex missions ever launched. The first challenge is getting to Mercury. Flying directly isn't an option. The sun's gravity means any spacecraft would be going too fast to make it into orbit. Instead, BEPI Colombo will take 7 years to reach its destination, combining solar electric propulsion with a total of 9 flybys of Earth, Venus, and Mercury. Once they arrive at Mercury in late 2025, the orbiters will separate from the transfer module to begin their comprehensive scientific mission in 2026. With its 11 instruments, ESA's Mercury Planetary Orbiter will study the surface and internal composition of the planet. Meanwhile, JAXA's Mercury Magnetospheric Orbiter's five instruments will study the planet's magnetic field. Together, the orbiters will not only reveal more about Mercury, but also the history of the inner solar system.
Very interesting. But Tim, you seem to be saying something has changed during that initial launch mission in 2018.
You got that right. So, after the launch, it was supposed to take 7 years to get to Mercury and be in orbit around that tiny little planet. However, in May of this year, a thruster glitch happened, and that prevented the spacecraft from operating at full power. They found out what the problem was, and it was traced back to a solar panel electrical leak. And what that's going to mean, though, is that the planetary flyby trajectories were changed, and now instead of arriving around Mercury in 2025, they're going to take an extra year and get there at the end of 2026.
In that clip, we heard ESA just gloss over the key parts of this slowing down challenge. You know, I think we should dig a little deeper here. Tim, let's start with an analogy, as, you know, we often like to do. Why should sending a spacecraft close to Venus slow the spacecraft down? And gravity is the answer, and that seems counterintuitive, but here's our attempt. Picture a guy on a bicycle working out at the velodrome. He's coasting along as he enters those steep corners, but he wants to slow down. By entering the corner and going upwards toward the outside, this allows the bike to climb the cambered track to the outside, and the gravity will slow him down. He still has potential energy, but he's going much slower, and he exits the corner at that slower rate of speed.
Now, I'm going to give some approximations that will put us in the ballpark of just how this planetary flyby is going to help in the real world to the BepiColombo mission. Let's say that on one approach to Venus, the spacecraft is zipping along at 40 kilometers per second. The trajectory will be close enough to allow Venus's gravity to draw in the spacecraft, but not so close as to allow entry into the atmosphere, which would result in a crash landing. Instead, the spacecraft will be drawn near to Venus, but have enough speed to escape, but will slow down to about 30 kilometers per second.
You know, that almost sounds easy, but I'm sure listeners are thinking, just where is the spacecraft heading after that? Is it going to go out into deep space? No, let's remember we're talking about rocket scientists. They have to tweak the spacecraft's orbit, despite the fact that it's millions of kilometers from Earth. They have to tweak it so they know precisely when to arrive at Venus, and they also have to know what speed and distance from Venus will work best to redirect the spacecraft to its next flyby.
And keep in mind that this is all about saving fuel and getting the spacecraft to decelerate. They do have rocket thrusters on board, but they only carry enough fuel to do a few limited burns along the way. Now, by the time BepiColombo arrives at Mercury, we've talked about how it's going to slow down. These flybys will have slowed the spacecraft down to about 3.2 kilometers per second, and at that speed, the spacecraft will be going slow enough that if the angle is right and the approach is perfect, it will indeed go into orbit. What could possibly go wrong, Steve?
I can't help but think of coming down the giant hills in Kamloops and they have the truck runaway zones when gravity is pulling you so fast that you can't stop. That comes to mind. But here's one, though. This spacecraft has to work with extraordinary precision, especially when it arrives near Mercury. And the temperature that close to the sun is about 450 degrees Celsius. There is a sunscreen supposedly involved to protect the spacecraft, but let's be fair to say, that sunscreen had better work as advertised.
But that's all the time we have today. So this is Tim Woods on Vancouver Island.
And Stephen Lowry here in Salmon Arm. And I'm planning a BepiColombo party in the near future, Tim. And so long, and we'll see you next time on
Space Talks.
Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along for a ride?